In today's lecture, we want to enter into a review of the major events that took place in the relationships between the two Israelite kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel in the north and the kingdom of Judah in the south, in the period between Rehoboam and Jehoshaphat, as far as the kingdom of Judah is concerned, and Jeroboam the first of the kingdom of Israel down to the time of King Omri. Now, this was mostly a period of warfare between the two countries. Not that they were fighting constantly, but that they had frequent encounters of a military nature. Now, we find that, of course, Jeroboam has established himself in the north. He has created a new capital, actually two new capitals that serve simultaneously, Shechem and Penuel. He has appointed a new civilian and military aristocracy, or top-level bureaucrats. He has established cultic centers at Bethel and Dan. He has made priests of the lowest of the people, so they owe their appointments to him and will be loyal to him and subservient to him. And he has moved the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, probably the most important of the pilgrimage festivals, the three pilgrimage festivals. He has moved it from the seventh month into the eighth month. These were the major policies which he set in motion as he sought to secure his hold over the northern kingdom. Now, of course, God was very displeased with these changes, and he indicated through a prophet that the line of Jeroboam would not prosper. This is contained in 1 Kings 14. We don't have to go over it in detail. It mentions how Jeroboam received a warning that because of these sins which he had led Israel to commit, that his dynasty would not be established on the throne in the way that God had originally promised, but that it would be completely cut off. And in fact, his son, who would have been his heir, died as sort of the seal that this would indeed take place. And we talked about this last time, that that this would not have had to have been, that God had promised him a sure house, like he had made unto David. Well, he did leave a son who eventually, after 22 years of ruling, did succeed his father, Jeroboam. But that son was removed, and that ended the line. And so that was how that particular prophecy of God was fulfilled. But in the 22 years that Jeroboam was to rule, he not only suffered the invasion of King Shishak of Egypt, even though the Bible gives it in the context that Shishak's main objective was Jerusalem. This is because the Bible is very selective in the details it chooses to present, and God is emphasizing the role of Shishak as a person executing God's judgment upon Rehoboam for Rehoboam's sins, which he committed in establishing various pagan high places in Judah. But in actual fact, as we find from the records of King Shishak, who was Pharaoh Shoshenk of Egypt, the northern kingdom suffered very heavily from the invasion of Shishak as he sought to gain control of the vital trade routes. Now, it mentions that towards the end of chapter 14, 1 Kings 14, in verse 30, that there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all their days. Now, I think we have to be careful here. It doesn't mean every day of the 20-some years that Rehoboam ruled that there was war. But there was tension, there was hostility, there were frequent outbreaks of actual fighting that took place between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And it doesn't specifically say in the Bible why. No specific reason is given. We come down to chapter 15, and we read that in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, remember he ruled 22 years altogether, so towards the very end of his reign, Abiam, the son of Rehoboam, became king over Judah. So we have a new king over Judah, while Jeroboam, the original king of the northern kingdom, is still on the throne there. Now, in the book of Chronicles, Abiam's name is given in a slight variation. It is given as Abiah. And this is not unusual, that frequently there would be these variations, both with the theophoric element or without it, fully present. These are just variations. We find it even earlier in the case of Jonathan, that sometimes in the text, and even in one chapter, his name is given as Jehonatan, and at other times it's given as Yonatan. And the case of a later king of Israel, his name is sometimes given as Jehoram, and other times as Joram. These variations appear frequently in terms of different kings' names, so they're not really a major problem. And so we have a new king now over Judah, and we find that, as it says in verse 3 of chapter 15, that he walked in all the sins of his father which he had done before him, and his heart was not perfect with the Eternal as God, as the heart of David his father. However, for David's sake, you know, he allowed him to prosper there in Jerusalem. Now, it just says in verse 7 that the rest of the acts of Abiam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And there was war between Abiam and Jeroboam. And that's all that it says. It doesn't give you any more details in 1 Kings as far as, you know, what went on. And so we do have to turn to Chronicles. So be careful. Where it says here, the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, that is not identical with the book we call Chronicles. Apparently, the book we have in our Bible, which is known as Chronicles, has as its raw material, the source, you might say, of a biblical book, is this book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. But it's not the same thing. There apparently were more things in the book of, that is referred to here in the text as the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah that ended up in our biblical book of Chronicles. So please be aware that they're not identical. But let's turn now to the biblical book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 13, and we will trace what happened in the days of Abiam, or Abiah, as he is called there. We open the chapter, 2 Chronicles 13, with the statement, "In the 18th year of Jeroboam began Abiah," notice the variation of the name, "to reign over Judah." He reigned 3 years in Jerusalem, not very long. His mother's name was Maacah, though the mother's name is given as a slight variation in the book of Kings again, as Maacah, the daughter of Uriel of Gibeah, which means that she must have been a Benjaminitess, one would presume, because Gibeah is the former capital of Saul. And there was war between Abiah and Jeroboam. Now, Abiah set the battle in array with an army of valiant men of war, even 400,000 chosen men. Jeroboam also set the battle in array against him with 800,000 chosen men, being mighty men of valor. In other words, the northern kingdom of Israel fielded about twice as many men as the men of Judah. Now Abiah stood up upon Mount Zemaraim, which is in Mount Ephraim. Now, that tells us something automatically. Abiah has invaded the territory of the northern kingdom. He has penetrated into the southern region of the tribal territory of Ephraim. And he gives this interesting speech. "Hear me, you Jew of Jeroboam and all Israel." Again, now the term all Israel was referring, of course, to the northern kingdom. "Don't you know that the eternal God of Israel gave the kingdom over Israel to David forever, even to him and to his sons, by a covenant of salt? Yet Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the servant of Solomon, the son of David, is risen up and has rebelled against his Lord. And there are gathered to him vain men, the children of Belial, and they have strengthened themselves against Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, when Rehoboam was young and tenderhearted and could not withstand them." In other words, he says, Jeroboam pulled this dastardly deed off when he was a grown man, a man of great wisdom and experience and intrigue and conspiracy, and Rehoboam was just an untried youngster who didn't know how to really effectively deal with this threat. Now, I leave it to you whether that's a fair presentation of the case or not. Just because something's written in the Bible doesn't mean that it's true. We have, of course, the first lie of the Bible coming in Genesis, of course, and yet it's there, so we have to be careful. But this is the way Abiah saw it anyway. This is the way he attempted to picture it. And now you think to withstand the kingdom of the Eternal in the hand of the sons of David. And though you be a great multitude, and there are with you the golden calves which Jeroboam made for you for gods. That's interesting. As you're trusting in your golden calves to give you the victory here, have you not cast out the priests of the Eternal, the sons of Aaron, and the Levites? You see, there is a reference to what Jeroboam had done. This is even more specific, you see. In the other place where we read it in Kings, it just mentioned that Jeroboam had selected the basest of the people from very low levels of society, to be his priests. This gives us more of the complete picture, as he actually drove out the Aaronic priests that lived in the north and the Levites that lived in the north. Have you not cast out the priests of the Eternal, the sons of Aaron, and the Levites, and have made you priests after the manner of the nations of other lands? In other words, have you not appointed these as court-controlled officials that have no independent status at all? So that whoever comes to consecrate himself with a young bullock and seven rams, the same can be a priest of them that are no gods. He's kind of ridiculing those golden calves there, saying, you pretend that that's, you know, an effective way of worshiping Yahweh, but they're nothing. You know, we've got the real place of worship for Yahweh. You people have only a miserable substitute. And anybody who has the price of a bullock and seven rams can become a priest in your society. Unlike us, we're very faithful. We maintain the real priesthood. Now, he's making it out as if, you know, God, obviously, in having to make a choice between two halves of his Israelitish people, all descendants of Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, let's face it, folks, he's obviously going to choose us. We've got the temple, the right priesthood, the Levites, and you've got this miserable substitute. How can you hope that you can prevail over us? You see, he's trying to get their psychological advantage, you see, over them by this type of speech. But as for us, the Eternal is our God. We have not forsaken him. And the priests which minister to the Eternal are the sons of Aaron, and the Levites wait upon their business. They burn to the Eternal every morning, and every evening burn sweet sacrifices and sweet incense. The showbread they also set in order upon the pure table, and the candlestick of gold with the lamps thereof to burn everything. For we keep the charge of the Eternal our God. We have not forsaken him. Behold, God himself is with us for our captain, and his priests with sounding trumpets to cry alarm against you. O children of Israel, don't fight against the Eternal, the God of your fathers, for you won't prosper. Now, was he correct? Was he truly stating the case? Based on what we've read in Kings, what do you say? Huh? Because the summary judgment of Kings is that that's not so. That he's engaging in some propaganda. Sure, the temple still existed, the proper priests still officiated, but he had encouraged and sponsored, alongside the official temple cult, things like his father Rehoboam had done. And so he really didn't have a pure heart before God. Really didn't have a pure heart before God. He is just trying to, psych these people out. Now it talks about Jeroboam causing an ambushment to come about from behind them. And so Judah's forces were caught as the filling in the sandwich between two parts of the Israelite forces. And in the geography class, we'll take a look at that and see how that probably took place. So that when Judah looked back, behold, the battle was before and behind. They cried to the Eternal, and the priests sounded the trumpets, and the men of Judah gave a shout, and it came to pass that when Judah shouted, it came to pass that God smote Jeroboam and all Israel before Abiah and Judah. The children of Israel fled before Judah, and God delivered them into their hand. Now, wait a minute. Why? We just finished analyzing the speech of Abia, which sounded so good. Yet, let's look back there again at 1 Kings 13. Did we goof? Did we not see something properly here? What went on here? Is 1 Kings 13 wrong? I'm sorry, not 1 Kings 13, 14, sorry. still wrong. 1 Kings 15. Now in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, reigned Abiam over Judah. 3 years he reigned in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah. And he walked in all the sins of his father. His heart was not perfect with the Eternal. How do we explain this? The two books just conflict? What's the answer, Corey? In large part for David's sake, but also, as it says here in 2 Chronicles, God was angry with both. But having to make a choice, he did, as it says here in verse 18 of 2 Chronicles 13. The children of Israel were brought under at that time. The children of Israel, Judah prevailed because they relied upon the Eternal, the God of their fathers. But at least in this particular battle, instead of looking to their pagan gods, they looked to the true God. And so God gave them the victory, despite the fact they were not perfect in their ways before him. And also as a way of punishing Jeroboam for his sins, which apparently God weighed as being greater than the sins of Abia at this particular point in time. So at least the people looked to the correct God, though they were worshiping more than him. And because the sins of Jeroboam apparently were greater, God gave the people of Judah the victory. Let's see the extent of it in verse 19. Abia pursued after Jeroboam and took cities from him, Bethel, which is of course the border. And then it mentions Shoshana with the towns thereof, and Ephraim with the towns thereof. Now, unless we look at a map, we can't understand to what extent Abia was successful. And we'll do that in the historical geography class. We'll look at the map and see how much territory Abia won. Neither did Jeroboam recover strength again in the days of Abia. In other words, there was no changing of the situation for the rest of the years of Jeroboam. He lived a few more years, but he did not redress this balance. In other words, round one, you might say, was the initial struggle between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Net result, nothing. No change, no substantive change at the expense of either kingdom. Round two is a struggle between Jeroboam and Abia. Victory to Judah. Now, what they gained and what significance it had, we will analyze in the historical geography class. But let's leave it for this class that the victory was given to Abia, the advantage, I should say, advantage to Judah in this round. But now we come down to chapter 14 of Chronicles, and it says, Abia slept with his fathers. They buried him in the city of David, and Asa, his son, reigned in his stead. In his days, the land was quiet for 10 years. And Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Eternal his God. He took away the altars of the strange gods, the high places, and broke down the images and cut down the groves, and commanded Judah to seek the Eternal God of their fathers and to do the law and the commandment. He also took away out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the images. Now the margin says sun images. And we are not positive, but we think we might have found something of this type in the excavations in the city of David. as to what the sun images might have been. These appear to have been horses with a sun disk between their ears. And this seemed to have been used in some way as an object of worship. And the kingdom was quiet before him. And he built fenced cities in Judah. In other words, fortresses. Built fenced cities or fortresses in Judah. For the land had rest, and he had no war in those years, because the Eternal had given him rest. Now, I don't want to follow right now with what follows here. Well, maybe... change my mind. I think I will. Let's just stay here in Chronicles, and then we'll go to Kings. Because Asa was to... now, maybe we'll stay in Chronicles, do the whole thing in Chronicles. There are two major conflicts that Asa faced during his reign. And they provide a lot of food for thought. Notice what it says in verse 7. That because we have sought the Eternal our God, we have sought him, and he has given us rest on every side. And so they built and prospered. Now, verse 9. There came out against them Zerah the Ethiopian. Now Zerah the Ethiopian was ruler over Egypt. He came out with a host of 1,000,000 and 300 chariots and came to Marisha. Now why particularly Marisha? Again, we'll look at that in the geography class and see what made that particular point a target for Zerah the Ethiopian, why he particularly wanted to gain control of that particular spot. Asa went out against him, and they set the battle in array in the valley of Zephatha at Marisha. And notice what Asa did as he, with his puny forces, faced this enormous army of Zerah the Ethiopian who had come out from Egypt against him. Asa cried to the Eternal his God, and he said, Eternal, it is nothing with you to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. Help us, O Eternal, our God. For we rest on you, and in your name we go against this multitude. O Eternal, you are our God. Let not man prevail against you. And so the Eternal smote the Ethiopians before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. And Asa and the people who were with him pursued them to Gerar, and the Ethiopians were overthrown and could not recover themselves. They were destroyed before the Eternal and before his host, and they carried away very much spoil. Now let us keep this in the back of our mind as we come down to chapter 16. Chapter 16 of Chronicles, it says here, in the 6th and 30th year of the reign of Asa. Now, apparently we do have some sort of a chronological conflict here. Hold your place here for a minute and go to 1 Kings 15, chapter 1 Kings 15, verse 33. It says, in the 3rd year of Asa, king of Judah, began Baasha, the son of Ahiah, to reign over all Israel in Tirzah, and he reigned for 24 years. In other words, Jeroboam died, his son succeeded him, his son was ousted by Baasha, who was not of the same family as Jeroboam. There was a totally new dynasty over the kingdom. Notice in the next chapter, 1 Kings 16, verse 8, it says, in the 20th and 6th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Elah the son of Baasha to reign over Israel in Tirzah 2 years. In other words, Baasha was no longer on the throne in the 26th year of King Asa. You got that fixed in your mind? 26th year of Asa, there was Baasha's son succeeded him. Now go back to 2 Chronicles 16. You see why this is an impossibility as it sits. The 6th and 30th year of Asa, Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah. But he'd already died and been replaced in the 26th year. So therefore, this is not possible for him to have been alive again 10 years later. Something is wrong here. And apparently what the text should have read is in the 26th year of Asa. Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah and built Ramah. He built a fortress at Ramah to the intent that he might let none go out or come in to Asa, the king of Judah. Now, what does that mean? He would not allow anyone to go in or come out from Asa. Again, without looking at a map, you can't see what this means. And we'll be doing that in the geography class when we do that particular map. But let's just take it from the point of view of where we are now today, that this was a major redress of the balance that had existed before. Abiah had gained the upper hand against Jeroboam. In Asa's earlier years, this had stayed the same. There was peace for the first period of Asa's reign. But now, late in Asa's reign, a new dynasty has come on the throne in the north. In fact, maybe we should separate these kings to show the different dynasties. The line of Jeroboam had come to an end, and we have a new dynasty in the form of a man raised up to take his place, Baasha. And he says, I'm not going to sit still and leave Judah with the upper hand in this situation. I'm not going to let that stay that way. We're going to not only get back the territory they took from us, but we're going to take away some Judahite territory in the bargain. And so he presses into the occupied territory. He drives the Judahites out of Ephraim. He crosses the border, and he penetrates into the tribal territory of Benjamin, and he builds in the tribal territory of Benjamin, slightly north of Jerusalem, he builds a fortress at Ramah. Now, Ramah, I would estimate, is probably no more than about 2.5 miles north of Jerusalem. Probably no more than that. About 2.5 miles north of Jerusalem. And that blockades, you might say, Asa in Jerusalem. Now, what should Asa have done? Well, I think you could form an opinion of what he should have done. Now look and see what he did do. Asa took out silver and gold out of the treasures of the house of the Eternal. Now let's be careful we understand what these treasures are and what they are not. These are not sacred treasures. These are not sacred treasures. This is not stuff that has been sanctified, dedicated to the service of God. But in the ancient world, temples were considered to be, by and large, inviolate. By and large, they were felt to be inviolate. They were the best safety deposit box you could find. And so the wealthy people of a nation used to put on deposit in the temple area their own personal wealth. So it was safer there than keeping in their own homes. Now what Asa has done is to expropriate private wealth on deposit in the temple. Basically, you might say he was exercising eminent domain over that wealth, saying this is needed for the national interest, and therefore it is confiscated to serve the national interest. And he also brought silver and gold out of his own house. He wasn't doing it just at his people's expense. He was making a similar sacrifice. And he took that wealth, that gold and silver, and he sent it to Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. Now, I prefer not to use the word Syria. The King James text likes to use Syria. I prefer not to. I prefer to use the word Aram. Now, I will usually, almost always, say Aram in the future where the text says Syria. I'd like you to understand why. Many of you, when you listen, you're busy writing or whatever, thinking, hopefully, instead of sleeping. And the words Syria and Assyria sound so close, it is easy to become confused as to which one you heard. So in an effort to reduce and, if possible, eliminate that confusion, I will say Aram when I mean Syria, and that way when you hear Aram, it's clearly different from Assyria, and therefore you can tell which kingdom we're talking about. Remember that Damascus, Ben-Hadad of Damascus, who was king over Aram, This is a very important power located to the northeast of Israelite territory. Right astride the major trade routes from Mesopotamia, Damascus, of course, was the beginning, the northern end of the major trade route we call the King's Highway. And in part, the struggle between David and Hadad-Ezer was a struggle for who was going to control these vital trade routes. And, of course, the victory went to David. Late in Solomon's reign, Damascus acquired its independence and reestablished its own power in Aram. And now, as king over that particular area, we have a man by the name of Ben-Hadad. Actually, his name is not Ben-Hadad. That is not a name, any more than the name Son of David is a name. It's a title. Ben means son. It means son of Hadad. Who in the world is Hadad? Hadad was the major god of Damascus, just like Yahweh is the major god of Jerusalem. So it is simply a title where these Arameans were expressing a confidence that their king enjoyed a special covenant relationship with their main god, Hadad, and had the special support and backing of this particular god, Hadad. And since there are several kings that appear in the scriptures with the same title of Ben-Hadad, in order that we can keep them straight, I'm going to introduce Roman numerals to them. So this you may consider Ben-Hadad the first, number Roman numeral 1. There are some others that we will see later as the relationships between Aram and Israel become spun out in later lectures. You'll also be given a chart that sort of summarizes the relationships between Aram and the Israelitish kingdoms, starting in David's day and going all the way through, because you get it in pieces in the scripture. So Asa took all this wealth and he sent it to Ben-Hadad, who was king in Damascus, king over the nation of Aram. And this is the message he sent along with it. Let there be a league between me and you, as there was between my father and your father. Well, we have no record of any league between Ben-Hadad of Aram and Abiah. It's not referring to his literal father. He is going back further in history. In the Bible, as in the ancient world, the term father was used loosely. And I think the best illustration, of course, is Christ's comment, you know, about the Pharisees. They said, you know, you boast that you have Abraham as your father. Well, yeah, you trace it all the way back through the intervening generations, he was their father. There's a big gap there. Or Christ himself is called the son of David. But David wasn't his father. He was father many, many times removed. This is just the way this type of genealogical information was treated in ancient times. So it's referring that in the past, back in the time of David, there was an alliance and a relationship between our two kingdoms. Behold, let's renew that. But of course, it's on a different basis. Before that, David was the superior in the relationship. Now, by sending the treasure, Asa is willing to take the junior role. He is buying himself an ally. Let there be an alliance between us because I'm going to pay you a nice big fat sum. Break your alliance with Baasha, the king of Israel, in order that he may depart from me. This guy's got a hammerlock on me, or he's got a stranglehold on me. What I want you to do is to harass him in such a way that he's got to let go of me. He's going to have to give me back my breathing space. So I'm buying your loyalty, Ben-Hadad. You go harass Baasha for me. Ben-Hadad hearkened to King Asa and sent the captains of his armies against the cities of Israel, meaning the northern kingdom. And they smote Eon and Dan and Abel-Maim and all the store cities of Naphtali. Again, in the geography class, we'll look at these particular places and see why, of all the places available to him, Baasha decided to attack those. And it came to pass that when Baasha heard it, know, that his kingdom was being ravaged in the north. Remember, he's got all of his forces in the south, where he's blockading Judah. And he hears he's being attacked in the rear, in the north. That he left off building Ramah. He let the work cease. In other words, he rushed north with his troops to take care of the problem. And so Asa, the king of Judah, carried away the stones of Ramah and the timber thereof that Baasha was using to build the place. And instead, Asa built Geba and Mizpah. In other words, all this nice building material that King Baasha of Israel had amassed for the building of this fortress, Asa appropriated and said, okay, I don't want to build a fortress here. I'll use it and move it and build these other two fortresses, Geba and Mizpah. And at that time, Hanani the seer came to Asa the king of Judah and said, because you have relied on the king of Aram and not relied on the eternal your God, the host of the king of Aram is escaped out of your hand. Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge host with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you did rely on the eternal, he delivered them into your hand. For the eyes of the eternal run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him. In this matter you have done foolishly. Therefore, from henceforth, you shall have wars. Now, the Bible does not explain any reason why Asa made this choice. It seems rather a strange choice. He went out to battle against Zerah the Ethiopian. He relied on God in a very humble, contrite way, and God just smashed the enemy. And now when he had this struggle with Baasha, which seemed like really, when you compare it, really small potatoes, when you compare it to what he had already seen, he doesn't take it to God. He relies on his own ingenuity to work out a way to get himself out of this difficulty. Why? Think about it. I'll let Mr. Suckling begin with that next time. As to why you think Asa made this decision. We can't answer it 100% because the Bible doesn't explicitly tell us, and there's nothing from any other sources that would inform us. But I think we should wonder about it, because we should draw a lesson for ourselves, lest in our own lives we make a similar error, maybe not the same scale, but similarly. And you notice the rebuke that came from God was very severe there. That God was not pleased, even though the overall approach that Asa used towards God was good. God did not like this switch in tactics. So think about that, and I'll let Mr. Suckling deal with it when he comes on Friday.